This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. It's been 3 months since severe storms caused flooding and other damage throughout much of Wisconsin. The December 17th deadline is fast approaching for residents to sign up with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, for assistance. But new and existing groups in the Cooley region will be here to support flood victims after federal officials are gone. Joining us today to talk about what resources are available are Michelle Ng, former chair and current advisor to the Regional Long-Term Recovery Group, Nancy Pierce, a licensed clinical social worker who provides mental health resources after natural disasters, and Hetty Brown, executive director of Cooley CAP, which is administering a new program called Project Recovery. So Hetty, could you start by talking about what is Project Recovery?
Project Recovery is a FEMA-funded program that provides outreach workers to disaster-affected communities. So in Wisconsin, after the 9 counties were declared federal disaster areas, this funding became available to the Department of Human Services, Wisconsin Community Action Program, and Cooley CAP to provide outreach workers across those counties to connect with survivors and organizations serving survivors to provide long-term recovery assistance.
How was Cooley CAP chosen to administer these services?
Well, Cooley CAP already serves flood or disaster victims through a few other grant programs that we administer. And all 4 of the counties we normally serve through those grant programs were declared federal disaster areas. So when the Department of Human Services reached out to the Wisconsin Community Action Program, which is a network of community action programs like Cooley CAP, they contacted us to see if we would be interested in bringing this program on board, not just in the 4 counties we serve, but the other counties that were also affected.
You know, as I mentioned in the intro, it's been about 3 months since the disasters happened. And so, you know, why is this kind of recovery project just getting, you know, started now?
Well, a lot of attention is given to communities right after a disaster happens, and that's the emergency phase. But recovery from something like that actually takes many months to years, and that's what this program is designed to serve. Project Recovery will work in 2 phases. The current phase is where we go into communities, we provide individualized assistance to survivors, and we help them navigate through the complex process that is recovery. But then the second phase will be individualized to the community's need long term. It may include components of public education or school-based programs. Really, it depends on what the community needs. But recovery takes many months to years. You know, a lot of the resources that pour into a community do help to get recovery started, but recovery is multifaceted.
And Michelle, you also work with another group that helps, you know, survivors of these sorts of natural disasters. So I wonder if you could just explain kind of what the long-term recovery group is.
Sure. The long-term recovery group for Region 1 started in 2007, and I participated at that time as their chair. It is a group of people organized under VOAD, which is a Wisconsin statewide program, voluntary organizations active in disaster. And the Long-Term Recovery Committee in this area serves to work hand-in-hand with Project Recovery. We hire case managers, and those case managers work to help survivors of flood events or other natural disasters to recover, identifying those unmet needs after FEMA and the federal government leaves this area.
So is this group kind of always active, or is it just kind of ramp up after a disaster like this happens?
We were active up until 2013, 2014, and after that we sort of put everything, closed everything down and waited, and then again ramped back up after the flood events.
Nancy, as someone who's worked in this this area of recovery after natural disasters, you know, I wonder if you could talk about maybe how challenging it is to kind of, you know, for people to always know kind of all the different sorts of organizations that are providing resources to, you know, disaster survivors.
I think it is challenging. It's hard to get over first the shock, the disbelief that this actually happened, even though it's happened before. I think most of us aren't really prepared. Most human beings don't kind of expect disasters to happen to them. So the idea of getting through the initial stage and then understanding, kind of becoming more informed about where the resources are and how to access them when you are still trying to understand what is happening to you initially. And even, I think most people think it goes quicker, it will be easier. And the idea that what I think Michelle said, which is that this is not a sprint, this is a long distance kind of event, in that it can take months, even years, to really have a recovery from such a large scale event. So I think it is real important for people to be informed where the resources are, how to access them, and then to recognize if in fact it has become difficult for them to kind of ask for help. There's often the sense of we can do it by ourselves, or don't help me, help the next person. But in fact, we recognize that it is sometimes challenging for people to ask for help, even during times of disaster.
This isn't the first time that Wisconsin, particularly the Southwest region, has been impacted by flooding or other natural disasters. And, you know, Hedy, I wonder if you could talk about, you know, maybe how resources look different this time around than they did maybe back in 2007 or 2008.
Well, I think that a lot of these programs that are offered no matter the event, like FEMA, like the federal assistance, some of our community development block grant programs that are being offered. As Michelle talked about, the long-term recovery group is also here to assist. But depending on a person's past experience with past disasters, depending on the special populations that exist in the community, the needs are different in every single disaster. Every disaster is unique. And disasters are non-discriminate. You know, they affect the entire community. But special populations within a community have different needs, and that is what's so important about multiple organizations coming together, like CoolieCap, like the Long-Term Recovery Group, so that we can address those needs differently. You know, a lot of the clients that we serve at CoolieCap normally are of low income. They struggle to find affordable housing. They struggle to find and work a job with a living wage. And so when you layer a disaster on top of that, it really disrupts their world even further. A lot of the people that we've been working with, they don't have anywhere to go because they already were challenged by finding affordable housing. And now the communities are even less resourced in terms of affordable housing. And then you have other special populations like the aging community, which, you know, may be isolated already or may be experiencing isolation after an event like this. So it's just a matter of finding communities and or finding populations within a community, addressing their needs individually, and not just using a cookie cutter approach that may have worked in a past disaster.
I'm glad you brought up this, you know, issue of looking at specific populations like low-income residents. You know, I wonder if you feel like if those residents are well served by kind of the typical approach of, you know, of having them, you know, operate through FEMA, that sort of thing.
I think that definitely those resources can really be a game changer for people who have been made homeless, for example, from the flood, or whose livelihood has been disrupted. Absolutely, it's important. But when a family has nowhere to go because the community as a whole lacks affordable housing, it adds an extra layer of need that other people with resources, such as a savings account or family members in the community who are well-resourced and supported, and may not struggle with. But yet those populations, too. I spoke to a gentleman the other day who received a FEMA payment that will pay off his mortgage, but it will also not pay for home repair. And he was depleting his retirement account to pay for home repair. So this is someone, too, that may not have been low income, but he may be pushed into that special population category or become low income or be financially strained because of this one event. And he may or may not have ever experienced that in the past.
Yeah, Michelle.
One of the things that has sometimes caused confusion is that FEMA comes in and everyone assumes that it's an insurance program and that they're going to make people whole. FEMA's goal, and I always address this as taxpayers, who we are the ones who are funding FEMA, and so when we see disasters happen, FEMA comes in, and right now their maximum grant that they will provide to a homeowner is right under $36,000. That is if your house is completely, totally destroyed. People aren't made whole by FEMA funds. And so when natural disasters happen and flood events happen, if you do not have insurance, that becomes a catastrophic event. And so another population that has been hard hit are those people who are working above the poverty lines that have never had that situation occur, and they're now facing a home that is catastrophically impacted, a mortgage, you know, that they can't pay off, and $36,000 to repair a home that they can't pay off. And so how do you recover from that? And so what we find is that there are many families greatly impacted who before August 27th thought that they had life, you know, maybe debt, et cetera, mortgages, but they could pay the bills, and now they can't, and now they're homeless, and they're facing a situation that they never expected to. And while FEMA is a taxpayer, we don't want everybody made whole because we would have to pay for that on April 15th. At the same time, it's not enough to make people recover easily and comfortably back to the normal lifestyle that they had before August 27th. And that's one of those grief moments that I think Project Recovery really helps with, is that the reality is a new reality that is going to be a lot of difficulty as people navigate this.
That's Michelle Eng, advisor for the local long-term recovery group, here with us today to talk about how community leaders in the Cooley region are providing resources to residents impacted by flooding in late August. She's joined by Hetty Brown, executive director of Cooley CAP, and Nancy Pierce, a clinical social worker. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Michelle, that's a hard reality for people to face, that they are not going to be made whole through a FEMA program.
It is, and it's devastating for people who are facing, really right now at this time, looking at resources. How do you go in to buy a house when you have an existing house with a high mortgage on it and no equity because your home is damaged beyond belief, and you have no resources? And so that's where the Long-Term Recovery Committee comes in. We connect people with resources. We look for community donations. We've been well supported by the community already, but we are trying to connect people with resources so that they can navigate this new normalcy that isn't normal and isn't something that they ever anticipated.
Nancy, how can people adjust to this new normal, as Michelle says? I mean, what does that take from a mental health standpoint?
I think a lot of the agencies that are getting together are going to help people to identify who needs help, who has some special needs or more vulnerable populations. But it does really mean people have to listen. We have to become really good listeners and truly wave the banner of hope. This is a tough time that we're entering into, with winter coming and the holidays coming. And I think the belief that people should be over it by now, as opposed to this is probably one of the harder times, this long-term recovery, that people's realization that it's going to take longer and it's not going to restore what they lost, not in the way that they had hoped. So I think the idea of how to help people to understand their reactions and what kind of positive coping skills can they use to deal with, to basically recognize, and then how do I work with the reality or the facts of what resources are available. That's the kind of emotional support people need, and helping them to link to the community, to support each other. This is an outreach model, and so we're looking to connect with people, networking, public education, referrals to services, all those things can happen. But I think it is hard. You're right. I think it's tough to hear that, and people understandably are trying to basically understand, how do I get through this? And I think the kind of support in listening, hearing people's stories, I'm a big believer in encouraging people. I often tell people, tell me your story, and then being a good listener and not rushing to judgment.
You mentioned that, we're kind of in the midst of the holiday season right now, and I just wonder if you could, dig a little deeper into that, how that can kind of compound this stress and maybe, kind of trauma that people are dealing with.
I think, I'm going to ask Hedy and Michelle to comment, but let me just say a couple of things about routine helps. Routine is healing. It helps us to kind of reassert the control that was lost. And whatever routine we can help people with to celebrate their holidays, to reconnect with their faith, if that is something that has helped them through tough times. Frequently, I'll ask people, what have you done in past crisis? Often people don't think back on what's helped them in the past. But in terms of the holidays, I think if there's a way that we can help survivors to have a holiday, to have presents for children. And children are, worth mentioning, are of what we consider a higher need or more vulnerable population. Children developmentally don't have the understanding about what's happening, why life has changed for them. So the idea of, you hear the stories about resuming schooling, getting your pets back, anything that will help you to give you those touchstones of sort of how can I get through it. And I think providing families, individuals, with those things that are important during the holidays would be an essential service to help them to get through this time and have a routine, have something that sounds like this is how we celebrate our holidays during this time or this time of the year. I don't know if Michelle or Hedy, if you have some thoughts of what would be possible.
Yeah, Michelle.
I can jump in a little bit. I think one of the things that I've heard in my conversations in past events and with this event as well is that people are devastated by the fact that they don't have grandma's platter to put their turkey on, or they don't have the Christmas tree that they had, or ornaments that they've always had, or maybe they've lost other holiday keepsakes that have been very integral to their celebration of the holidays. And one of the things that was helpful in 2007 and both in 2008 is that celebrating a new tradition, it's not going to look like the same tradition, and there is definitely grief about that, but there is also the ability to say, okay, instead of using our Christmas tree that we've always used, let's go out and cut down a Christmas tree at one of our local Christmas tree farms, or let's make new decorations. Maybe it's a paper chain or stringing popcorn, but let's celebrate as a community, as a family. And that sometimes helps. It's recognizing that the old traditions may be gone because those tangible concrete things were washed away in the flood, but there is a way of overcoming and celebrating new traditions, and that sometimes gives people hope.
Hedy, I wonder, Michelle mentions kind of coming together as a community to make new traditions. And I wonder what your thoughts are on, how communities in this region who had residents who were impacted by flooding, are we doing a good job of kind of coming alongside those people?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. In this area, especially, I have seen amazing examples of entire communities coming together. You know, you have the first responders who are really the heart of the community. They were first there. You have the churches. You have the local community groups. Then you have organizations like ours that come in after and also try to help people regain some sense of normalcy and provide them depending on their long-term individual needs. And that community rally and support can really make a huge difference for a family. And the challenge is how do you maintain it? Right? Because the communities, you know, of course, come together right after the disaster. And what we're here to do is to say that support needs to continue. We need to provide door-to-door outreach. We need to go to senior meal centers and help not just support the people who are coming who are affected, but support the people who serve the people affected. Project Recovery not only will work with individuals affected, but will also work with their family members and friends who care about them. We will work with first responders or other organizations that are serving survivors, because we as a community need to stay strong and resilient and connected in order to best help people. And that's what Project Recovery is designed to do, is to bring together and help to maintain those networks.
And just kind of looking over some of the materials you guys have put out, you know, one thing that really struck me was that you mentioned that, you know, these outreach workers are going to be helping organize and prioritize recovery tasks for individuals and families. I mean, that seems like a very simple thing to do, but I wonder if you could talk about how that might be challenging for some people.
Yeah, well, first, after an event like this, there are so many different organizations there to help, which is great. But if you're someone whose home has been destroyed, you don't even know how you're going to get your kids to school or how you're going to get to work, even working with an employer to make sure that they can give you the time off to navigate, adding the additional stress of having to go to different agencies or organizations, call different numbers, go online to register, it can just really be daunting, overwhelming, frustrating, and you see a lot of people just start to shut down. And that's what Project Recovery can help people do: review their options, navigate through those options, cut through the red tape, whether we're there to help answer questions. Maybe we make the phone call to the agency and ask questions on behalf of the person just so they don't have to deal with it. We help them fill out an application, or we just sit and listen to them as they are working through those processes themselves. So we can help them review their options, navigate the red tape. We can also provide that emotional support. We can go to appointments with people. Some people going to the disaster recovery centers to register for FEMA. Our workers can accompany them in case they need some help through that process. So it really is about customizing depending on the state that the person is in and what they need from us at that moment.
I mean, that's very in-depth help for flood survivors or victims. And, you know, I just wonder how many families are you anticipating, or how many individuals are you anticipating are going to need that kind of assistance?
It's hard to say right now, Hope, actually. We know that across the 9-county area in the original disaster assessment, FEMA assessed, I think, over 1,000 homes affected. But those were homeowners and not even necessarily everybody in a community who was affected. So it's still early in the program. We're not quite sure how many people that we're going to be able to connect with, but outreach workers are going door to door to do just that. Michelle, I don't know in past disasters if you have any indication of the numbers of people who were served.
Well, right now I can tell you that as of last Friday, there was over 1,000 people registered in the 4-county area that have been impacted. Now, when I say registered, that they have registered with FEMA for the disaster, there are still people out there. We know because there were more people who reported to 211 prior to this event, or prior to FEMA coming in and being declared. It is really important. The deadline is December 17th to register for FEMA. Again, it's not going to make people whole, but it starts as a baseline. Some funds, some help, some assistance. It opens doors to other funding. People can register by going to 1-800-621-FEMA or 1-800-621-3362. They can also register for online at disasterassistance.gov. They have until December 17th to do this. So it's really critical if you, and I, again, I'm going back to that taxpayer analogy. We have been paying into FEMA. Every time we pay our taxes on April 15th, we pay into FEMA. If you have been impacted by flood events, this is not a handout. This is a tax rebate. This is money you have paid in. And so it is, while it's not going to make you whole, it helps. And so it can help through a difficult process. So please register.
Yeah, and Nancy, you mentioned earlier that some people might not be quick to register with FEMA, and I just wonder if you could talk about kind of what are those roadblocks that might prevent someone from wanting to register and why they really should.
Well, I think that's a good thing for us to recognize. I think Michelle mentioned we know some people, but the task is to try to identify those people who are reluctant. And I like the idea that she emphasized this is not a handout. People are proud. People don't take handouts. People think of helping their neighbors. I was struck by somebody who I talked with whose home was destroyed and said, I'm the helper. I'm never the person who asks for help. And so the idea of trying to tie in the, the kind of this is part of, you know, if you live here, these are the services that we want you to apply for. That will open up other resources. Other things that can get in the way are people are tired, and perhaps feeling a bit overwhelmed, maybe a lot overwhelmed. And so the idea of doing one more thing is more than what they can do. And they sometimes do appreciate somebody going with them, helping them to almost to kind of do a gentle jump start of, I will go with you. I will be there with you. And being a support during what is, for most people, a very unfamiliar process. So the prospect of doing something different, unfamiliar, maybe even they'll want things or they'll want to know things that are that are private or that I don't want to talk about. They may not even want to talk about the losses they've experienced because it is distressing and they have kind of continued to be a bit avoidant, not think about it, not talk about it. Perhaps there's a challenge as to why they're not applying for services. I think that there are many reasons. Some people don't have things like I'm not familiar with, the familiarity with language, with how to even sort of figure out sort of the kind of how to sort of maneuver or navigate the systems can be a bit overwhelming when you aren't comfortable doing that. So that kind of support of literally walking with the person, so to speak, walking alongside of them can help them kind of bridge the gap or to make that jump to applying for services. Sometimes it helps to find out who would be a good person to help you. That would be a support person. If it's not somebody from the team, who else might it be? And there are often people who they really trust. They already have established supports, and to kind of not supplant them, but in fact include them so they can help the person. Sometimes people have needs that that really prevent them from doing, you know, the kinds of applying for resources, whether it's disability, mental illness, substance use, those kinds of things. Those can all become challenges and often made worse when there's a lot of disruption, even crisis in their life.
Nancy Pierce is a licensed clinical social worker who provides mental health resources after natural disasters. She's here with us today to talk about resources available to Wisconsinites who are impacted by flooding and severe storms in late August. Also joining us are Michelle Ng, advisor for the region's long-term recovery group, and Hetty Brown, executive director of COOLICAP and their new program, Project Recovery. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation on local programs addressing the physical and mental health needs of disaster survivors. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Wisconsinites who were impacted by flooding and severe storms in late August have until December 17th to sign up for assistance through the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. But local community groups are just getting started providing resources for flood victims, addressing everything from how to rebuild homes to how to deal with the stress or trauma that comes with natural disasters. Joining us today to talk about these new and existing programs for flood victims are Michelle Ng, former chair and current advisor to the Regional Long-Term Recovery Group, Nancy Pierce, a licensed clinical social worker who provides mental health resources after natural disasters, and Hetty Brown, executive director of COOLICAP, who's hosting a new program called Project Recovery. Before the break, we were talking about, the FEMA assistance deadline, December 17th. Hetty, you brought up a good point that this is not just for, homeowners or residents who are affected.
Right. We also want to encourage business owners. If you are a business owner in the community or you own and operate a farm, please make sure to also register with FEMA. There are resources to assist you. We have encountered a lot of people who not only may be affected personally, but their livelihoods have been affected as well, and they're trying to recover in that respect. And then if you're a farm owner and operator, especially your livelihood is so tied into your way of life as well. And so we are offering resources not only from a project recovery perspective and a long-term recovery group to assist those individuals, but we also want to say that if you own a business or a farm, please register with FEMA. If you own a farm and you've registered with the FSA, that is not the same thing as registering with FEMA.
Yeah, Michelle.
I think it's important to note, so you register with FSA, that is for your crop losses, animal losses, fencing, etc. But a lot of farmers aren't registering with FEMA for things like their wells. And the wells are something that were greatly impacted by flood events. You have water going into your water supply. And we find that people don't think about testing their wells, and I've heard of a number of farmers who've had to replace wells because obviously groundwater contamination gets into the wells and creates great issues and health issues. So it's really important for farmers to register with FEMA. If you aren't sure if your well is safe or if you've bleached it but you haven't tested it, register with FEMA and then get a test. At least you're registered with that deadline approaching. We don't want you to lose out of that opportunity if your well is compromised. So yes, register with the FSA, register with the SBA if you're a small business owner, and then make sure that if you have personal loss, like a well on a farm, that you're registering with FEMA.
How can, having businesses or farms, how can that have ripple effects within a community? You know, I think of some of these small communities along the Kickapoo where almost every business in town was flooded. I mean, how does that kind of ripple out through the community?
I can share a couple of stories about that. We've got one community where, for example, it's a new normalcy again, but when your community network is frayed. And so, for example, there's a bench in one of our communities where a couple of people always congregated in the morning and talked and shared a lot of stories and worked out the problems of the world. That bench is gone. That business is closed. That group doesn't meet anymore. And so some of those community networks that are present and are the livelihood of a community, not only in the business sense, but just in that community frame that this is a thriving community, we've got friendships and groups that are meeting. When those networks are frayed, it's devastating to a community. So it's rebuilding those connections, both at the business level, and then those services, like the bench out in front of a business, that that becomes part of that community.
Hedy, you know, we're talking about the FEMA deadline that's quickly approaching here. You know, if people don't register with FEMA, can they still access the resources through Project Recovery?
Yeah, Project Recovery is a program that's intended to last at least a year after the disaster. So we will still be here ready to assist individuals, families, business owners, community groups, all throughout the community throughout the year. So you can contact Project Recovery through our toll-free number at 844-260-7029. You can also email projectrecovery@cooleycap.org to connect with an outreach worker, or visit the Cooley Cap website. There's a Project Recovery page that tells more about the program and how to connect with an outreach worker. And we come to you. This is not another situation where you're going to be asked to come to an office or fill out a form. We will come to you, and then we will listen to your needs and help navigate through those needs alongside you. And that may be a one-time visit, or it may be several visits over time. It just really depends on what you need as an individual.
And Project Recovery is a program through FEMA funding. And I wonder if you could share how much funding this project has.
Well, the funding, it really will come in two stages. The first stage that we're in right now is our startup phase. So FEMA has provided a grant to the Wisconsin Department of Human Services, who's subcontracted with the Wisconsin Community Action Program and Cooley Cap, to get the program up and running, to get it launched, and get outreach workers in the field. They also provide in-depth training for these outreach workers, although several of our outreach workers have been active in past disasters, so they know the program and they're very well experienced. So that's the first phase. During this time period, the Department of Human Services is applying for a second grant that will take us out through the end of the year. I'm not quite sure how that, you know, how much in the end will come our way. But right now we have funding to provide free services across a 9-county area through up to 20 outreach workers. So we have plenty of resources to connect with people who need us.
I want to return to another issue that was brought up in the first half. Nancy, you brought up how kids are often vulnerable populations after a natural disaster. And, you know, I just wonder if you could share more about, you know, how flooding or events like this can really, impact children.
I think that we do have to pay attention to children. Often adults would like to believe that their children are too young, or the idea of they're being affected is hard for them to recognize, to accept. Often they're the most vulnerable for those impacted during and after a disaster. And anything that affects or threatens the safety, their safety or safety of their caregivers, their parents, can have an impact on them. Disasters are unfamiliar events. They're not easily understood. Children find them emotionally confusing and frightening. And sometimes, out of necessity, children have to be left with someone else, a family member or other caretaker who are unfamiliar to them. And they often don't get much information, pretty limited. So we do have to pay attention for our younger children if they're appearing more withdrawn, especially when they're with friends or playgroups, when they're really craving or, demanding more attention. I have seen children who are terrified to leave home. They seem to be less connected or engaged in their schoolwork. It's hard to learn when your mind is filled with other more pressing and distressing events. They can become more aggressive, more difficult to lose concentration, focus. You can even see it in terms of how they sleep and how they eat. It's really the basics. And I would encourage parents to be on the lookout for that. And certainly teens can can be affected as well because their routine has been pretty disrupted. So they can become more withdrawn or become less willing to follow directions, resisting authority, a little more disruptive, aggressive, and sometimes will engage in higher risk behaviors like drinking and some kind of misuse of drugs or taking risks in terms of behaviors. So to check on children who have maybe had prior trauma in their life. Perhaps they're living in a, if they're living in a shelter, if there's clear loss of, let's say, home, personal property, if there's a big disruption in life and parents are not working, or they lost somebody or a pet, anybody who was involved in the disaster. And I think the kind of what we need to do is to give them time to experience the world as a secure place again, and to get that emotional support to recover. They're watching how their parents and relatives, teachers, caregivers are responding. And these are the people they often turn to for comfort and help. So the adults play a very important role after disaster or other crisis. And we need to really try to reinforce those normal routines to the extent possible.
Michelle, I wonder if you feel like our schools are prepared to help kids, recover from the flooding and other disasters.
I don't think anyone's ever prepared, but I think our schools have been definitely very responsive. I know that in one of the school districts I'm very familiar with, when the first rain fell right after the flood events, teachers were responded and knew that there were kids who had been impacted and were able to deal with kids who were very frightened because, let's face it, when the rain starts coming down and you've been rescued out of your house by a boat, that brings back really severe memories, and you're wondering if your parents are safe, you're separated. So there was a lot of teachers and principals who were very cognizant of that and definitely were aware of those impacts and continue to be aware of those.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about how programs available to help residents impacted by flooding in late August. We're here with Michelle Eng from the Regional Long-Term Recovery Group, clinical social worker Nancy Pierce, and Hetty Brown from Cooley Cap. A lot has been talked about in making individuals and communities resilient to these flooding events. As we see them happen more often in recent years, more focus has been put on resiliency. And Hetty, what does resiliency look like?
Well, I think one of the key things that we can do as a community to build resiliency in areas that not only are continuing to experience disasters, but have for many, many years. I was in Lafarge yesterday and looking at some of the history of the flooding there. Lafarge is a community who's experienced devastating floods since the 1800s and possibly before that, but they don't have records. And so I don't want to ignore the power in policy. Policies can be implemented in Wisconsin to help communities prepare for and better address these situations. So, for example, if we have more investment in affordable housing development in safe areas, then families with low income will have access to that housing under normal circumstances, because normally, to find affordable housing, they're forced into areas that have been devastated in the past with flooding and other disasters, but they just can't afford housing elsewhere. So if we had more policies and investment in affordable housing development, in eviction prevention, in creating and maintaining high-wage jobs so people can build that savings account or can afford insurance to protect themselves, these are all things that could really help to build a more resilient community overall, because if we don't deal with it on the front end, we're going to be dealing with it afterwards as a community, and that's what's happening now. So as an advocacy organization, Cooley Cap not only responds after an event, but we also advocate for policy change to prevent in the future.
Have we seen any interest from policymakers in these sorts of changes?
Well, I think that there definitely are conversations happening in Madison about these devastating events and what could be done in the future. Whether that will translate into legislation, we'll see in January with the new session starting. But our membership agency, Wisconsin Community Action Program, is talking to lawmakers about what can be done to prevent this in the future.
Michelle, as someone who has, you know, worked in this area since 07, 08, I mean, do you feel like it's going to take change now instead of, you know, proactive change instead of just a response?
I think that's a key to preventing it from happening again. And I know our community leaders are engaging in discussions about that and what that will look like in the future. We've had a number of events. This one happened to be declared by the national, by the president as a national disaster, but we've had a number of events over the past couple of years that weren't declared disasters. And so these communities have been feeling the impacts for several years and are looking at ways that they can prevent it from happening. Obviously, you don't want your town washed away. Gaze Mills was very proactive in 2007 and 2008. They've been kind of the poster child for resiliency in this area, and that's one way of addressing it. There are many others, and I think communities are really talking about how does this look in the future.
Yeah, do you feel like there are examples? I mean, Gaze Mills is often held up as kind of that, you know, finding a solution to, you know, constant flooding. But are there other examples of innovative ways in this area that communities are kind of addressing this issue?
I think part of the problem that right now exists is that we are seeing much more devastating rain. And so one of the questions that's come up is, where and how much rain, you know, we look at FEMA flood maps and we say a flood map, we can expect a 100-year flood or a 500-year flood. But we're not seeing the same type of flood events because the rain has changed. And so we're not getting accurate information. And so I think one of the innovative ways our communities are having to address this is stepping back and saying, okay, we were prepared for this. We've got floodplain ordinances in place. Now we're getting flooding where floodplain ordinances aren't in place because the rain situation has changed. So the innovation is changing because we can't go back to the ways and means that we've used in the past. And so I think that's been kind of one of the discussion points and hurdles that we're having to address is that we have to recreate this completely.
You know, as we think about resiliency, Nancy, I wonder if you have thoughts on how people can also build resiliencies. Individuals and families can, you know, build personal resiliency as, you know, the potential for events like this happening in the future grows.
I think it's a really good point. People are somewhat, we use the word resiliency a lot. People wonder, am I born with it? Can I acquire it, learn it? And I think there is something to be said about teaching people the skills. Some people have a natural ability to kind of bounce back or to ride it out. But most of us, I think this is a skill that I would think we can teach individuals, groups, even communities. When we talk about paying attention to, you know, what we're feeling inside, you know, kind of the turmoil, the ups and downs, and how to rebalance our nervous system. The second skill could be how to identify resources. How would I know, you know, what gives me comfort, calm, joy, those kinds of things. And so it might be just saying, what are those external resources? They could be positive experiences, memories. They could be people, places, activities. They could be internal resources. Those kind of things that we all have in ourselves that help us to heal. And then what kinds of things can we do to build, you know, to kind of, how can we kind of enhance our connection to those resources? Writing them down, writing down circling one resource that might be helpful, details about the resource. So these are things that I think we can do as people. Again, that's that kind of, what people would like to do is to kind of go back, undo what happened. And they try hard to do that, kind of thing, what could I have done if I could have done it better? Those kind of self-questioning, even self-doubt about what they did, versus going forward and saying, okay, I can't change it, So what are the things I can do, the coping resources that I can use that will help me deal with it as it is now? Whether it's building resiliency that will, I believe, enhance recovery, whether it's accepting help and recognizing where the resources are and how to access them. And so I think teaching, modeling, those kinds of skills are important in terms of building resiliency.
We've been talking with Nancy Pierce, a licensed clinical social worker who provides mental health resources after natural disasters. Michelle Eng, former chair and current advisor to the region's long-term recovery group. And Hetty Brown, executive director of CoolieCAP, which is ministering a new program called Project Recovery. About what resources are available to residents impacted by recent flooding and how these programs are providing long-term support for the region. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.